You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kamat Hozo, Turin Hozo, Shodre Thomas Owen, Dawson City Huchin, Natsen DJ, Hatruno Tanjo Ha, Freda Hokai.
This is AUT's communication professor, Thomas Owen, introducing himself in the native language of the Trondike Huichin people. Owen is currently on sabbatical in Dawson City, with a population of only 1,300. It is one of the most remote towns located in the vast Yukon of Canada, and the centre of the self-governing nation of the Trondike. He is currently stationed here to conduct a myriad of research regarding the self-governance of the Trondike Huichin. I speak with him to find out exactly what he's looking into.
I'm up to a few things here, but predominantly research-wise, I'm looking at self-governance. So the Trondike Huichin are a self-governing First Nation. That means they have relatively open scope to design their own laws, to make their own policies, to govern as they see fit for their own citizens. And I'm here looking at what that means for a variety of different things, primarily what that means for education. So what does that mean in terms of what the tribe here can do for their citizens who are going through school?
Right.
In mind, that the school system up here over the last century or so has generally been a negative experience for the community.
So in terms of their self-governance, is this similar to how Indian reserves work in the United States, where they're effectively their own little nation and have their own laws?
Yeah, with one major difference that if you're living on a reserve, chances are that reserve has been set for you by the government saying this is where we're forcing you to go to, usually not on the traditional lands and usually quite low quality land. There's a lot of the problems around that. I imagine, though, one thing we've got to bear in mind is there are many, many, many different First Nations across Canada and many other Native American groups across the United States. And there was no uniform process of colonization for each group. You know, if you think about, say, the Mohawk down in the southeast of Canada, you know, they were interacting with Europeans 350 years ago. The Trondike Huichin, up where I am in the Yukon, really before 100 years ago, there'd been very few Europeans up here. It's so isolated, it's a harsh territory. So you might have had the odd trapper. But it was only with the Gold Rush 100 years ago that Europeans came.
Right.
So, you know, if you think of New Zealand, kind of Europeans, Treaty of Waitangi and things, you know, that's 150, 200 years ago. Well, 150 and 200 years ago, the Trondike Huichin and First Nation here, you know, had very little European engagement, where other parts of Canada had already by that stage several centuries of colonialism by a slightly different Europe to the one we saw in the 19th century.
Right.
So I just put that out there to say, you know, every area, every tribe's got their own unique stories. But in terms of, is it like a reservation? No. And the major difference, I guess, would be that the Trondike Huichin and the other 17 or so First Nations of the Yukon Territory never signed treaties with the government.
Okay.
And that was quite key, because it meant that when in the sort of late 20th century, 1970s, 1980s, they started to then negotiate with the government saying, hey, we never signed a treaty with you, so now we want to govern a modern treaty, which they call a self-governing agreement.
Right. And what impact has this self-governing agreement had on the Trondike Huichin?
Well, it's allowed them full self-governance. So now they're their own entity. They sit alongside the Yukon Territory and the nation state of Canada as a self-governing unit. But obviously that puts them in a pretty weird situation, right? You've got, I don't know how many million people live in Canada, but, you know, many. And then you have about 40,000 people living in the Yukon, and they have their own government. And then you have the Trondike Huichin, who are made up of about 1,500 citizens, are then their own government, with apparently, you know, the same rights and privileges as the other governments, but of course a massive disparity in terms of power and resource and economics and so on. So what it means is that the Trondike Huichin then looking at setting their own laws, looking at setting their own fiscal policy, justice policy, education policy, but doing it against this behemoth that is the nation state of Canada, against their governance partner in the Yukon territorial government, and of course against 100 years of colonialism and the legacy of that and what that's done for the community and so on. So, yeah, what does it mean for them? It means a very complex and fascinating, constant negotiating engagement with these other co-governance partners.
You mentioned disparity. Much of your research is surrounding sort of the disparity of their schooling systems. Would you be able to elaborate upon this?
Yeah, sure. So I'm not sure if too many New Zealanders would have heard of the residential school system in Canada. I think more and more people are hearing of this. And to be honest, up until the most recent years, many, many Canadians had never heard of this history because they'd largely concealed it. It wasn't taught in schools and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, the residential schools is much like the stolen generation in Australia, where Aboriginal children, First Nations children, were forcibly removed from their homes and put into boarding schools. And these boarding schools were they were different across Canada, and Canada's enormous, but typically state-run and typically run by the Catholic Church. And these schools would bring First Nations kids in away from their families. They'd mix them all together so that they, not necessarily with other ones that they knew from back home. They weren't allowed to speak the language, be dressed in uniform, their hair would be cut, they wouldn't be allowed to practice customs, physical abuse, sexual abuse. Certainly, psychological abuse were rampant. And one of the most damaging things, too, is that a lot of the kids then had very little access to their families and to traditional ways of being. So not only would you lose access to the language, but just basic stuff like how did we parent? How did we raise our children? How did we live on the land? The children were spending their time away in an institution that deprived them of that knowledge.
Right.
So that's obviously a horrible history that only ended at different times in Canada in the 20th century, but up here in the Yukon, I think the last school closed in the 1970s.
Really? Wow.
So very, very recent history.
Yeah.
And the community that I live in here, Dawson City in the Trondae Quechan, many, many, many people who are still with us and still alive went through that school system and were not only deprived, but were also in many cases abused. And that's left a real intergenerational trauma there to address.
So has the self-governance of the Trondae Quechan created a more accepting schooling system from this residential schooling system? Like, is it now customary to teach native culture and language?
Yes, exactly. No, you've got it there. I mean, that's one of the big changes. And the Trondae Quechan government made education a real priority. They realized this and said, we've got to address this, because at the moment it's not just that, because once the residential schools ended in the 70s, then a sort of mainstream Canadian education system came in. And, that was all well and good, certainly much better than the residential schools, but it also was largely targeted to the types of skills that, say, a white student living in Ottawa might need, maths and science and university entrance, and didn't reflect a lot of Indigenous worldview. So the Trondae Quechan said, well, hey, we're now self-governing. We can change this. We could rewrite the curriculum. In fact, what we could do is take all of the First Nation kids out of school, put them in our own school, and make it entirely First Nations driven.
Right.
Just have it elders and Indigenous approaches to the world and to knowledge and so on. And they thought, we can't really do that because we're already an integrated community. We're already a community with a lot of non-First Nations. About half the community is non-First Nation. And we want to move ahead as one community. So how do we raise the status of Indigenous knowledge without delegitimizing everything else that school is trying to do?
And have they achieved that? Or are they still in the process of doing it?
I'd say both. It's definitely a work in progress, but some, to be more specific, some things they have achieved is a lot more involvement of elders in the school. So elders are key in the traditional community. You learn from the elders, the teachers, political leaders, and so on. That was the traditional way. Kids would learn from their grandparents by watching and doing. So they're bringing the elders into the school as storytellers, as guidance, So that's a big part. Other ways are they're taking the classroom out onto the land a lot more. Traditionally, Trondae Quechan wouldn't sit in a classroom. That didn't exist. They'd be out on the land learning by doing, whether that's hunting or trapping or smoking and preserving fish. So that's become part of it. Now they've made these, what they call culture camp, actually part of the curriculum. So for all the students, First Nations and non-First Nations. And that's a big thing because traditionally, say 10 years ago, if you're a First Nations kid, you'd probably go out for the hunt anyway, with your parents and the family. But then you'd be marked as absent from school, and then you're seen as a bad student and so on. Now what they've done is say that hunt is part of the curriculum. We'll go out with the elders, we'll hunt the moose, but we'll also make it part of the biology lesson.
Right.
You know, talk about, you know, use some Western science, talk about what we're doing. We'll also make it part of your English class. When you come home, you're going to journal and you're going to talk about that hunt, not just the hunt of the moose, but the culture around it, the stories the elders told. We'll make it part of your physics. You know, we're going to make a moose caller in our physics class and talk about how that works. So they're trying to get that sort of, you know, that beautiful integration of the two. So bringing a lot more of that type of thing. And then, of course, the language, vitalizing the Han language that Klondike Kwetchen speak, and doing all of this with as much Han language as possible.
Do you feel that the New Zealand schooling system would be able to learn a thing or two from the Klondike Kwetchen and the way they approach cultural education?
Yeah, I think could learn from anyone, but I think also the TH of the Klondike Kwetchen is looking to New Zealand a lot. I mean, the types of things I've just described might sound pretty familiar to New Zealand educators. I think the types of kind of political issues a self-governing First Nation is facing here with changing education, other types of things the Kura Kaupapa movement in New Zealand would probably be quite familiar with. You know, we've been trying to do these things in New Zealand for a few decades. But I think there'd be interest both ways. I mean, it's interesting here because you've got it's a small community, so you can sort of try things without making them standardized for a whole city. You know, you can try things out and see if they work. And there's great successes, and I think students here are really benefiting, and I think teachers are really benefiting. But there's also still tensions and questions asked. You know, okay, this is great, but how does it translate into, say, exam success and those type of statistics that, you know, university entrants might be more interested in? Is this type of education going to help? It might help students engage meaningfully with the world and with their culture, but what does it mean later on down the track? And these are open questions that certainly the government and the Klondike Kwetchen government and the school here is very interested in ironing out and working the best way forward.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.